From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. economy grew by 2.5% in the third quarter, the fastest pace in a year. The Congressional Debt Reduction Super Committee met in public Wednesday, but the real action continued behind closed doors. A Democratic proposal was leaked and countered by a Republican offer, but taxes remain the stumbling block. President Obama announced economic measures that don't require congressional approval, including one to ease student loan debt. And GOP presidential hopeful Rick Perry unveiled his flat tax plan. The domestic hour of our Friday news roundup after this update.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Consumer spending is up, but only because people have been digging deeper into savings. The Commerce Department says spending rose 0.6% in September, but personal income was up only 0.1%. Scott Brown is chief economist with Raymond James.
One disturbing element was that the disposable income, after adjusting for inflation, has been trending down over the last 3 months.
The savings rate has now fallen to the lowest level in nearly 4 years. Tennessee state troopers have arrested more than 24 protesters who refused to heed warnings to clear out of an area near the state capitol building in Nashville, where they were camping. The demonstration is in support of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Daniel Potter reports some of the protesters fled as police moved in.
Katie Savage says police surrounded the others.
Those who were prepared to risk arrest sat in the middle and sat down and saying, "We shall overcome together," while the police approached them. And many of them went limp when the police were grabbing them and cuffing them, and it was completely nonviolent.
Now, a judge has reportedly said there was no probable cause for the arrests and ordered the occupiers be released. Savage says protests will continue today. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Potter in Nashville.
Excitement in eastern Turkey today as workers rescue a boy from the rubble of an apartment building that was toppled by last weekend's earthquake. The 13-year-old had used a rock to dig out a space for himself in the crushing debris. He drank rainwater that he was able to collect and used his shoes as a pillow while he awaited help. The head of the European Union's bailout fund is in Beijing today. He's in talks to convince China to invest in the fund, which is being bolstered under terms of a plan to resolve the European debt crisis. Francis Lun with Lindsay and Holdings in Hong Kong says it's in China's best interest to invest in the bailout fund.
By helping European Union, China will gain valuable political points, which sometime in the future will have to be repaid.
Stocks on European exchanges are higher today, extending their gains following announcement of the deal to help resolve the debt crisis. The U.S. and South Korea are working on additional steps to deter any future provocation by North Korea, which Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says poses a serious threat to peace on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korea continues to defy the international community as it enhances its nuclear weapons, its ballistic missile programs, and continues to engage in dangerous and destabilizing proliferation activities.
Panetta was speaking in Seoul after conferring with his South Korean counterpart today. Panetta is on his first trip to the region since he became Secretary of Defense. On Wall Street, stock prices are modestly lower this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 23 points at 12,186. The Nasdaq Composite Index is off 12. This is NPR News. Saudi Arabia has moved quickly to name a new crown prince just days after the funeral of Prince Sultan. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports the next in line to the Saudi throne will be Prince Nayef, the interior minister.
Nayef will become king after the death of Saudi King Abdullah. While Abdullah is considered a reformer by the cautious incremental standards of this oil-rich Gulf kingdom, Nayef has a reputation for resisting change, and he has strong networks of support among Saudi religious conservatives. Nayef is valued among Western counterterrorism officials for his efforts against Islamic extremists in the kingdom. He also drew criticism, though, when he said, quote, "the Zionists benefited from the 9/11 attacks." This was the first succession decision by the new Allegiance Council, a 37-member body established by the king to bring a slight measure of transparency to the process in this absolute monarchy. Peter Kenyon, NPR News.
Russia has successfully launched a new advanced ballistic missile. Jessica Gallagher reports from Moscow. The Kremlin hopes the Balava missile will be the future of its military arsenal.
The missile's warheads reached the Kira testing range on the Kamchatka Peninsula, about 3,500 miles away. The missile is a three-stage hypersonic intercontinental missile. It can carry up to 10 individually targeted nuclear warheads. Russian officials say the missile is capable of dodging potential missile defenses. The Balava is the Kremlin's most expensive post-Soviet military project and is planned to dominate Russia's nuclear arsenal as officials gradually retire aging Soviet missiles. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
Appliance maker Whirlpool is eliminating about 5,000 jobs, the move aimed at cutting costs in the face of soft demand and higher expenses for materials. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures, presenting Anonymous, the new thriller that explores the theory that Shakespeare never wrote a single word. Now playing.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. economy grew by 2.5% over the summer, easing fears of a second recession. Cities began cracking down on the Occupy movement with arrests, and President Obama unveiled both a new student loan plan and a plan to help underwater homeowners. Joining us for the Domestic Hour of the Friday News Roundup, David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg News, and Byron York of the Washington Examiner. You are always a part of this program. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So the economy grew by 2.5% in the third quarter. Is it enough to fend off the prospects of a double dip? Gene.
Yes, an uptick in consumer spending has economists saying that we are avoiding that trap for now. The uptick in consumer spending was 0.6%, so it's not a huge lift, but it's a signal that maybe consumers are getting back into the market. And as we all know, demand has got to increase before we're going to see any real expansion in the business community and job growth.
And a lot of folks, Byron York, looking at what consumer spending might be going through the holidays.
Sure. I mean, this is objectively good news. Given the fears that we had a couple of months ago, the stock market seemed to be going through the floor, fears of a double dip. So 2.5 is actually quite good. One little caveat about the consumer spending, it appears that the savings rate actually went down at the same time, indicating that maybe people are spending their savings as opposed to having more money to spend.
Interesting that a report showed, David Korn, that state tax revenues rose for the first time since the recession began. How come?
Well, probably because of more economic activity with the growth we've seen. It was 0.6% growth in the first quarter, 1.3% in the second quarter, and now 2.5. So it's kind of like doubling. Now, I don't think it's only 5% in the next quarter, though that would make people very happy. But, you know, the states have been hit really hard, and they've had all these cutbacks in rescue workers and police and teachers, and they still have, you know, a lot of them still have a lot of red ink to deal with. But that's good news for, I think, for working families.
And yet local government revenues appear to be going down, Jean.
It's very confusing what's happening out there. But it is worth noting that, as well, when we talk about this growth of 2.5%, there are two revisions coming up. And every time we've had a revision for the last couple of quarters, the number goes down.
Explain that revision.
Well, they have part of the initial number is an estimate, and then they go back and they look at real numbers, and they start bringing, and it start each time the number has gone down once they've looked at real revenues and real growth. And so we should be cautiously optimistic that this was our growth and that maybe it will continue through to the fourth quarter.
And yet you had the Congressional Budget Office saying yesterday that Wall Street, exactly what the occupiers are saying, that the rich are getting richer while the rest lag behind, Byron.
Well, can I say one more thing about this, the growth rate, which is that its effect on the unemployment rate, which is more important to most people, is unclear here. Given the fact that the country is always growing, 2.5% is about enough for the economy to stay in place, which is great considering it was going backwards for a good while. But it's not enough to get people really back to work. On this 1% thing, we should say that they're talking about a 30-year trend. I believe it was 1979 to 2007. And what they found was that the top 1%, their income had, after inflation and after tax income, had increased a rather enormous amount, and the smallest, the lowest portion had increased, I think, by only 18%.
So the disparity is 75%.
Yeah, I mean it's almost 20 times or 15 times the amount, and it shows. I mean, you look at wages over that period from the post-war period up until now for middle income earners. And they've been flat. You know, they were going up a lot, you know, through the first couple of decades in that period, and now they've been flat for a long time. And this is really, I think, at the core of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which we can talk about. It has its ups and downs, and it's sort of inchoate still at this point. But people get a sense that America, which used to be a fair country economically, is not as fair. You see the disparity in incomes, but also you see the disparity in treatment. So when people, you know, the Wall Street guys and gals who had all those shenanigans, it's, you know, that enriched them and sent the rest of the economy off the cliff, have gotten off largely scot-free.
Byron.
Can I add, there's one detail in this that's really quite interesting. It is true that the finance sector has grown enormously in that period, and their compensation has grown enormously. But the role of federal transfer payments, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, has changed in that period. And a larger percent of it used to go to the lowest percentile, and now it is spread more throughout the economy, which is that the safety net programs have in this time period become kind of middle-class programs as well, which I think is going to add fuel to the idea that you need to means test some of these programs.
But that surely doesn't account for 275% growth in the top 1% of the earners granted last 30 years, Jean.
No, it doesn't. And even if you see an expanded use of government programs, it doesn't mean that they've become middle class programs. It well likely means that people are falling out of the middle class and their incomes are at a level now where they qualify for these programs because they're poorer, not because the programs have inched into the middle class.
So what do you see as the implications of these new figures? And by the way, Byron, you asked before the program began about the jobless claims. They decreased by 2,000 to 402,000 the week ending October 22nd. But what are the implications of this finding by the CBO that you've got a 275% increase in the top 1%?
Well, an obvious political implication. I think there are tremendous social and cultural implications, but a political implication is that we're having a debate, which we're going to be talking about on the show, about what to do with the U.S. government budget and deficit and the debt issue. And it's a fundamental divide that has not been solved in the last few years or in the last few months, which is the Democrats say, okay, you want to say we're going to cut back Medicare. The average Medicare beneficiary lives on $23,000 a year in income, and you we say, we'll look at that to some degree, but we want to see some extra revenues come from the people who have doubled their income in the last 30 years. And you at least see the Bush tax cuts expire. The rich did pretty well before those tax cuts. And the Republicans keep insisting. We almost had, you know, a government shutdown over this. We almost had a default over this, that we will not raise taxes on the rich.
Gene.
Well, it isn't a doubling. It's almost a quadrupling of the amount of money that the 1% has increased their income by. It really is an astonishing number. And it comes out, as David said, there are cultural implications, but the more immediate one is political.
Exactly.
Because it does play right in to the debate that's happening.
But
where,
is it affecting the debate with hundreds of lobbyists lobbying the super committee, a range of more than 600?
I think it will affect politics. I do not believe at this point it will affect policy. And the reason for that is that both of the political parties in Washington are dug in. They are where they are, and they're not going to move before the election.
But how can they continue to call it a democratic process, Gene?
Well, it is. The Tea Party wing of the Republican Party is still ascendant, is still the strongest tug in their caucus. And they are adamant, or you see no movement from the Tea Partiers, that they would allow or let pass new revenues without first seeing deep cuts.
And
they have also put all of their members, the Republican members of Congress, on notice that they're going to hold them accountable.
Byron.
I actually agree with that. I don't think we're going to see any changing in positions that we saw in the debt ceiling fight and that we're now seeing in the super committee fight, because they are in part based on philosophy. The Republicans believe that top 1% has a disproportionate amount of talent, smart, and ambition, and more so than the lower 20%. The rest of us. Certainly in the top 20%, and I believe that myself. And the question is the disparity too big? There's going to be a disparity. And they also believe, Republicans do, that is the job-creating class, and they're not going to budge on that. And this is a difference that they feel will be solved by the 2012 election, not by a grand bargain.
This leak that came from the debt reduction super committee? What was in the plan that the Democrats were offering?
I'm happy to talk about that, but it's important to note that there is a little movement on the Republican side. There are a couple dozen Republicans who have signed a letter organized by Representative Steve LaTourette and some others, sort of more moderate, some who are associated with Boehner, saying everything should be on the table, including some form of revenues. So they're kind of pushing back on the Tea Party. So this is not quite a civil war within the Republican ranks yet, but it shows that there is indeed movement away from the Grover Norquist, last stand.
Quickly.
They should make a distinction, though, between revenues and taxes. And going the tax reform route is a way to solve this problem in a way that Republicans do not want to simply raise taxes.
Byron York, the Washington Examiner. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Occupy movements around the country and take your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back here in the studio for the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup. Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg News, David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. We will take your calls in just a few moments, 800-433-8850. Talk about these Occupy movements around the country, Byron, and what kind of an impact do you think they might have on not only raising the awareness of the public, but getting through to members of Congress?
Well, let's put aside this issue in Oakland that happened the other day, which was very newsworthy and a real mishandling of the situation. And on the Occupy movements in general, it strikes me that they're quite small. They are inchoate. And I have to say I've not been to the one in Manhattan. I have hung around the Occupy D.C. protest. And it strikes me, looking at it, as very similar to some of the anti-war and anti-Bush protests that I covered in 2002, 2003, 2004, just kind of a bunch of group. I think one time they even had their Dick Cheney puppet there. It's just kind of a bunch of mostly fringe lefty types who don't have a lot else to do right now.
Gene Cummings.
Well, they may be small, but their impact is much larger than that. And if they are the groups that were out there in 2004 or they represent them, then the Republicans in Congress ought to be pretty darn nervous, because it was in 2006 that they started to have major losses in Congress. So I think that the groups themselves will see how long they last. If it starts snowing, that could be the end of Occupy anywhere, except maybe somewhere in California. However, what we have already seen is that they have lit a fire under some of the traditional Democratic activist groups. We did a report this week at Bloomberg. Labor is energized by them. MoveOn.org is energized by them. So they have had a political impact. Whether they last remains to be seen.
Here's the question. The group of whom I talked to a number of people this week, if we can call it a group, have said they wish to begin a dialogue. What would that dialogue be comprised of?
Well, I think they have given voice to a deep-seated resentment that goes far beyond drum circles. I think across America, people have felt like they've gotten the raw deal, while people at the top, the 1%, Wall Street, the big financiers, have gotten taken care of. And I think there was a lot of anxiety. I wrote a piece 2 years ago, Mother Jones, about where was the popular anger about this. And I think it was mainly a year or two of anxiety. People worried that the economy would really collapse. And now that things have settled and they see who's at top and who's still struggling, the anger is sort of coming back in a slow way.
But I'm still worried about the dialogue.
No. So now the question is, this is a movement that can either stay kind of impressionistic, or it could go more towards policy and platforms and electoral politics. I mean, the Tea Party was lucky in that it had people like Americans for Prosperity and the Koch brothers come in and say, great, they can be our electoral battering ram and fight for things that we want with a veneer of populism. And they gave them buses and jets and money and organization. This movement won't work that way. But the question is whether it does have an impact on people running for office and on politicians already in office who see it as sort of a, cliche, but the tip of a sentimental iceberg.
This group could go the route of the Tea Partiers if they wanted to. Labor has opened the door to provide a backbone and organization and finances to it. However, when you interview the folks who are involved, they talk a lot like the Tea Partiers in that they want to stay out of the system. They don't want to be co-opted. They, in some ways, are as mad at Congress as they are at President Obama. These people are frustrated at every single level, and they feel that Washington as a whole has let them down, and they don't want to become a part of that system that they feel has failed.
You know, it was interesting that this week you had another high-profile arrest of a former executive on charges of insider trading. That kind of fuels this whole discussion, Byron.
Well, it's interesting. James Carville and maybe some other Democratic strategists have suggested, you know, the Democrats need to arrest people. I mean, these are criminals and everybody's mad at them. The Justice Department, we can all be thankful, has decided to only do it in cases of actual criminal activity. This kind of stuff is just a classic Wall Street insider trading corruption case. Whether there are thousands more of them, I don't know.
You know, one manifestation of Occupy Wall Street, it may not seem obvious to people, but I don't know if you saw the picture, Diane, this week. Elizabeth Warren, who's running for Senate in Massachusetts, had to put a meeting out, a call out for volunteers. And literally hundreds of people packed this town hall meeting. It looked like a presidential race. So people out there, and she sort of represents what I would call the policy side, maybe the within the establishment criticism of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And when she called for people, I mean, if I was Scott Brown, who she'll be running against probably in the fall, I'd be, you know, thinking about my next job, because to have that sort of energy at this stage of a Senate campaign, it was mind-boggling.
Elizabeth Warren may well prove to have hit the perfect sweet spot for her campaign, for her message, and for her both her academic and the role she has played in politics, because she has been the voice of the consumer for the last few years, and that seems to be where we're at right now, where we have consumers, little people, the 99%, looking for some kind of champion, and she's already been there. If she can rally around that, it may, in fact, propel her into the Senate. That remains to be seen.
Byron.
Well, perhaps she would be the answer to your question about the dialogue. I mean, the question on the dialogue was, well, who's going to talk for them? I mean, they don't seem to have anybody who really speaks for them, and they want it that way. Can it turn into have some sort of electoral impact the way the Tea Party did in November 2010? We're nowhere close to that right now, but there's still time.
See, I keep wondering not only about who it is who might speak with somebody, but how that discussion would begin and what these folks who are with Occupy Wall Street would say. Jean?
That's a really hard question, Diane. There have been several polling groups that have gone to the various Occupy locations to try to figure out what is the message. And there are many messages. Some of them are, you know, go far, far left, where, you know, there's a real socialist bent to what they think the solutions are. Others are students who are underwater, who are just so frustrated. Others are people who are out of work, who've been looking for a long time, who just want to get a job. So we have lots of messages very similar to the Tea Party, in that there were a lot of reasons people came out, and it coalesced around the idea of taxes and health care reform. If there is a way, and I think that the White House is toying with trying to figure out a way to funnel all this energy and direct it at one or two messages, then they could have some impact. And one of the messages, clearly the White House had already been setting the Republicans up for this, is that the Republicans are protecting millionaires in the battle over how to deal with our debt. Byron. They're on the side of millionaires. I'm on the side of you.
Did you see the video of Alec Baldwin when he visits the Occupy Wall Street? It could be part of a TV show, but basically he's saying to them, well, you know, I think capitalism is really okay and we need robust capital markets. Actually, he's a spokesman for a bank. But, you know, we can't just throw the system out. You guys want to get rid of the Federal Reserve. We actually need a currency. It struck me that you can see a real division between sort of standard liberals like Baldwin and the people who were there, who were just a mixture of a bunch of people who want to throw people in jail. They want to get rid of the banks. They want to get rid
of
the Fed.
Have that, you have that.
They do all sorts of stuff.
You have that within the Tea Party too. There are some aspects of the Tea Party that are far right libertarian that want to, you know, and, you know, get rid of the Fed as well, and, you know, like Ron Paul. And there are some who
common ground.
You know, I know. I mean, there is. Eventually, this has to be, you know, the conversation has to, you know, focus on some specifics, whether it's a jobs program, whether it's a transaction tax, whether it's more transparency in politics. But I think the overwhelming sense is we want leaders who we believe are looking out for the bottom 99%, rather than the top 1%. And there are different ways you can show that.
Let's talk about how the Obama administration is trying through executive order to accomplish some things like this new student loan plan. What does it do, Jean?
Well, the student loan plan, it essentially just tweaks with the current system and reduces the amount of money that students have got to pay back in the course of their loan. Right now, the required payment on student loans is at 15% of discretionary income of students post-graduation, and this would reduce it to 10%. And so it just gives them more time to pay their student loans back. And it allows them to keep a little more of the money they earn in their pocket. And what's interesting with this and the proposal the president came out with just about a week ago on home ownership is that what the White House has done is it's pretty clever positioning. They have spent a month out there on the campaign stump running against the do-nothing Congress. And they ran on that until Congress didn't pass the jobs bill. And then they have pivoted in the last 2 weeks with we can't wait, and he's stepping in and using his executive powers to try to get relief to people who are struggling. So they are setting up the political argument about why him and not them.
But surely it's not all politics. Surely it is an effort to help students and to help homeowners.
The biggest and best thing that the president can do for his own political future is to help people and to help the economy. That's the tax cut deal of last December was basically a second stimulus. It would have done more for the economy had we not had gas prices go up and the Japanese tsunami and the European crisis. People tend to look at this, I think in Washington too, as who's up, who's down, what gives you the political advantage or not. If the president can do anything to get the conditions on the ground, the economic conditions, to improve even marginally, that's good for Americans. It also happens to be good for him.
He can only do so much. This is the kind of stuff that Congress really does, and the measure that Gene talked about with the student loans going from 15 to 10% of your disposable income is something that Congress has already passed. He's using his executive power to speed it up, to accelerate the process. The Atlantic Monthly did, I thought, what seemed a pretty persuasive analysis of the student loan thing and found that it would help the average student loan holder by about $10 a month. It is not a big deal, and it doesn't address this weird situation we have where the cost of higher education are just going up and up and up. And as it goes up, the political system just calls for more loans to feed that system. It doesn't address that.
Byron York of the Washington Examiner, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How many people is this student loan thing going to help? How many people is the housing plan that President Obama introduced going to help?
I saw the Atlantic Monthly piece that Byron mentioned, but there was also an AP piece that said, up to a couple $100 a month to help some students. So I think it's still open which analysis is correct. The White House says, and at the beginning of a program, it's hard to tell, that 1.6 million people will be helped by the student loan. On the home foreclosure business, they originally had this plan called the HEMP plan that they thought would hit, would help millions of homeowners who were underwater, and ended up only reaching about 800,000 people. And so what this new plan does is sort of, make it easier to get access to that. So they're hoping for a couple of million, but I gather that up to 15 or 20 million people might be in needing of this help, and whether they can do it right to reach all those people is going to be the big challenge.
All right, let's move on to two flat tax plans on the table. Rick Perry's first. He introduced this Tuesday. He would scrap a graduated income tax plan, replace it with a 20% flat tax. But here's what I didn't quite get, and Byron, maybe you can explain it to me. He said that those people who want to continue with the current plan could do so, And I found myself seeing a gigantic IRS trying to figure out who's doing what.
I just happened to have written about this week and talked at length with the Perry people about this. And it is an optional system. There are a number of other tax proposals, like Paul Ryan's tax proposal, which propose essentially a two-part system, which says, here's our new flat tax plan. We would like you to enroll in it. However, if you want to stay with the current situation, your current tax system, you can do that too. So what's going to happen in a situation like this is everybody's going to look at it, they're going to do the math, and they're going to figure out under which system would I pay less taxes. Problem is, about 46-47% of the public pays no federal income tax, and that's what we're talking about here. 23%, about half of those, actually get money back from the government in terms of the earned income tax credit. So they're going to stay with the system. And then there are the people who have who don't get money back, but they have zero tax liability. What do they change for simplicity's sake? So probably half, maybe more, of the people aren't going to go into this new system.
Gene.
Well, it is a complicated proposal, despite the fact that they were trying to come up with something as simple as snappy as 999 in Herman Cain, although that proved to be too simple.
Zero.
He had to change it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's not a flat tax. It's some kind of incline. I mean, he says 20%, but you could still get your mortgage deduction. You could still get your charitable deductions. So it's not as flat as what Cain initially proposed. And it's further complicated by the fact that not only can you you could choose where you want to, what kind of tax you want to pay under the current system or under his new plan. You could do that every year. And so talk about a big IRS. People from year to year to year could be flipping how they do it. There have been similar proposals by other Republicans who say once you pick one of these methods, you have to stay in it for a certain period of time to create some continuity.
Let me add one thing. The Perry people have told me that that's actually not the case. Under this proposal, when you're in, you're in. So they don't see people going back and forth.
It seems to me it'll be a full employment plan for accountants. But both, you know, Herman Cain's 999 or 909 or whatever it's going to be next and the 2020 plan of Rick Perry, you know, fail the Ronald Reagan test. Ronald Reagan said that, you know, bus drivers should pay lower rates than millionaires and business people. Every flat tax that comes down the pike lowers taxes for the well-to-do and either keeps them at the same for the lower folks or actually raises them.
David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine. When we come back, we'll open the phones and hear your thoughts. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, offering email marketing and social media resources for marketing small businesses. Learn more at constantcontact.com. By the Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to improve Americans' understanding of Muslim arts and cultures. And by Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com. This is NPR.
You've heard the headlines. Now find out what they mean for you. Top journalists offer expert insight and analysis of the week's major news stories. Join us for the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Thank you. And this hour of the Friday News Roundup will be up on our website, portions of it, in about an hour. Here in the studio, David Korn, Gene Cummings, Byron York. Let's go to the phones. Plantation, Florida is first. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning. One thing in the domestic area I haven't heard talked about either on TV or on the radio is what is happening to municipalities, because states are in a better position to meet their bond obligations, but they push this down to the municipal level, to towns and counties. Michael Lewis, who wrote The Blind Side and Moneyball, had an article on Vanity Fair's website called California and Busted. And he talks about two towns in California and the fact that hardly anybody works for the town anymore. One was Vallejo, and I can't remember the name of the other one. But what dire straits they're in. And also Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, not an insignificant city, just declared bankruptcy. And I haven't heard anybody in the national media talking about this or what it means for people that have annuities that are tied up in municipal bonds.
You know what, Cindy? We have done programs exactly on that. Just to let you know, you could go to our website and check that out. Jean.
Well, she's absolutely right. The first stimulus that was passed by Congress, it sent a lot of money to the state and local communities. And all economists pointed out that once that money went away, the true condition, the true financial condition of the states and municipalities was going to come to fore, and it was going to be a dire situation because of all of the job loss, because of the continued unemployment, and all of the lost revenue. And so that is our bleak situation right now. It's the makeup has been wiped off, and this is the true financial condition of the country right now and its governments.
All right, to Bill in Lewis, Delaware. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. An observation leading to a question. Since 1979, we've seen near stagnation of the personal wealth and income of the average American. At the same time, the personal wealth and income of the top 1% increases substantially. And this is a period when Republicans began the erosion of the tax rates, federal income tax rates. Now, there's certainly a relationship there. And the question is, do Republicans really believe this stuff? They seem to be calling for more tax reductions, especially on the top 1%. Do they really think this is good for the United States in the long run?
But,
well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think if you look over decades, the federal government, whatever the tax rates are, has ended up collecting about 18% of gross domestic product. And how much we spend, of course, is a big issue. And now we're getting, it's less than that now. It's like 15% because the tax collections are so bad. But over these years, the federal government has been collecting about the same amount of money the whole time. And there has been an enormous growth of spending and a number of things. We're headed for a huge expansion of entitlement spending. But I think it's reasonable to ask, do you have to collect more money if that's what we've been doing for decades?
But I think if you're going to have two wars and have expand Medicare to do a drug prescription benefit and, give, a tax cut back to people on the top and say, we're not going to pay for this, well, that certainly is, it doesn't matter what the tax rates are then or what the tax revenue collection is. You are putting yourself on the path to a gigantic fiscal hole, and that's what happened. And then when it comes around to fixing that hole, to say, well, what are we going to do? We're going to cut back on people who low income Americans who need medical assistance, or we're going to look at people who have just quadrupled their wealth in the last 30 years.
All right, to Logan, West Virginia. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I'd just like to thank all the people in the Occupy movement. The commercial press fractured fringe movement of some sort because of their disparate grievances. But I believe they're only expressing what actually 100% of Americans know and feel, that our government is closed to the public, and there's been a corporate takeover of our government, and we want our government back.
Gene.
Well, the caller is right in that if public opinion polls that have been taken in the last couple of weeks indicate that not a majority, but about 40% of Americans agree with the message of
Occupy Wall Street,
that they that the haves have gotten too much, and the rest of America have been suffering and taking big hits. Only about 25% don't agree with them. And it has been called a fractured group. It's been called lots of different things. The Tea Party faced the same thing. They were called lots of things before when they first started out. And what they turned out to be, in large measure, were ordinary Americans who were just really frustrated with Washington, D.C. And in the long run, it could be that Occupy Wall Street is coming from a different place, but is really just ordinary Americans, as the caller is, who are just very frustrated at how their government has not been able to help them in a time of such economic hardship.
Here's an email from Cynthia, who's listening on WNIJ in DeKalb, Illinois, and apparently we've had several like this. She says, if the top 1% have had such a large income increase in the last few years, where are all the jobs they have created? Right now, she says, I feel our country has been hijacked by political interests. Most American people are struggling to get by while the politicians continue their wrangling.
You know, productivity has gone up tremendously in the last couple of decades. So basically, businesses are getting more work out of workers. So they have to have less workers and pay them. You know, their labor costs aren't as high. We've had a lot of outsourcing, which we've talked about. We have a lot of people who make a lot of money here who park that money outside the U.S. in bank accounts that are undisclosed. I mean, there's a lot of ways for people who are making money to sort of take that money and either use it for their own benefit and not really invest back in America. There's no law that says they have to. And if they're not going to, then I think that's where you have a tax system come in to try to say, okay, we're going to try to keep some of that money to build America, which you have done very well by.
Byron.
Remember, this is a 30-year trend from these CBO numbers that we're talking about. That 30 years would include the Clinton boom years. I doubt that you had many shows devoted to this issue during the Clinton boom years, and yet those same things were going on just a few years ago under George Bush. The unemployment was, 4.5%, something like that, not a huge amount. There are temporary conditions that exist now, and we all know what they are after the collapse.
They may not be temporary. That's the issue. I mean,
that's the concern.
You had this buildup of deregulation, and you had the expansion of the casino economy based on Wall Street that held the rest of the economy hostage, and it all kind of collapsed. It doesn't mean that this is not necessarily a boom and bust cycle. This may be a transition moment.
There are other statistics out there that show that in the recession, the wealthy did better, and while the 99% were suffering. And so this is not just a 30-year trend. This is about the last two or three years. And the public, if you do focus groups, if you go out and interview people, they're angry that the wealthy have gotten wealthier, that the banks, as we all know, are sitting on cash. And the answer that they hear is that these people need more money to create jobs. And that caller and those emails are raising, I think, what is going to be the next big question in this debate. Where are the jobs?
All right, to Dennis in, to Padraic in Dennis, Massachusetts. Good morning.
Yeah, I'm calling from the Cape and Islands, WCAI. At this point, the subject's kind of been beaten to death. Ms. Cummings said earlier in the program that this was a demand-side problem, and it's been discussed that there's been a 275% expansion of wealth in the upper echelons of the economy. And I just felt like I needed to point out that the past 30 years of economic policy have done nothing but help the supply side of the economy, when what we're looking at is low consumer spending and low consumer confidence, and those are demand-side problems. We need education, we need health care, and we need jobs and higher wages.
And
Byron.
Here again, this concern, and it's absolutely real and it's legitimate, but it is the result of a time in which we have 9% unemployment right now, and these same trends were going on earlier at earlier times when their unemployment was much lower, employment was much higher, and to treat a temporary situation as if this is the way life is going to be forever from now on is probably wrong. I'll say one little example. From 93 and 94, when the deficits were a big problem, there were about $250 billion a year, which seemed huge at the time. There were many, many predictions that we were facing deficits like that, federal budget deficits, as far as the eye could see. There was a surplus within 4 or 5 years. I'm not suggesting things like that will happen right now, but I'm suggesting it is absolutely wrong to take temporary conditions and suggest they are going to exist for the rest of our lives.
But you have to address the seriousness of the problem. 93, 94, what did Bill Clinton do? He raised taxes on the wealthy, and he had led to surpluses and an expanding economy, and everybody was happy. Now, what the president's agenda this year is to do exactly what the caller just asked for, to invest in education and to deal with the rising health care, innovation, R&D, all the things that Republicans want to cut back tremendously, dramatically. So they're not investing in the future. They're not doing anything now. All they're saying is if we cut government, somehow that will lead to a magic recovery, which there is no basis in the past to believe that. It may be true, but
Let's
it's an article
go to
of faith.
St. Clair Shores, Michigan. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Diane. I'm a huge fan. My question is if one of your panelists suggested that the talent ambition in America comes from the top 1%. Is it possible that that talent ambition is a product of their socioeconomic status? And if so, what does that suggest about fairness and social mobility in our country? Thank you.
I was the one who said it, and let me amend that to the top 20% versus the bottom 20%. I think that there is more talent, smarts, and ambition in the top 20% of the earning class than there is in the lowest 20%. Maybe I'm wrong. People move. The great thing about America is people move from one percentile to another. But that's a result of their own effort and their own talents.
David?
Well, we see poverty rates have gone up in America in the last few years. And if there is no doubt that people move and that America is a dynamic society. But you go look at a school in Bethesda and you go look at a school in Anacostia or some other place, and you can't tell me that that's not a level playing field for most Americans.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to Whittier, California. Good morning, Gary.
Hi, Diane. I'm one of your big fans, like so many callers, first time that I've called.
I just want
to say I am not a mostly fringe lefty with not much to do. I am a professional. I am an airline pilot at the biggest airline in the United States. You can't believe the devastation. I'm a captain who's going to retire soon. My co-pilots, people who have served our country in the military, the way that they have been treated, they cannot save enough money for the retirement that we've lost, put their kids through school. Dour journalists, conservatives like Byron York, cannot help themselves from denigrating this movement. But this Occupy Wall Street movement, I support it. So many of us support it. I'm tired of the way it's put down by these conservatives.
People disagree about that. I mean, clearly there was a lot of liberal commentary on the Tea Party when it was having big rallies. I just gave my observations of what I've seen.
Gene.
Well, and they were wrong about the Tea Party. And in all likelihood, people are wrong to denigrate this group. As I've said a couple of times on this show, we found out about the Tea Partiers that they were ordinary Americans who were very frustrated that Washington was not helping them. And I think what you have with Occupy Wall Street, again, are ordinary Americans finding a voice, finding a way to vent their frustration at Washington for not helping them during this time of economic need.
Here's an email from Matt, who says all the polls I see show a large majority of Americans in favor of higher taxes on the rich. If the Democrats stick to a message of we can't pass a jobs bill or fix infrastructure or reduce the deficit because they won't raise taxes on their rich friends, it seems to me they will have the public on their side and pick up many seats and hold the White House. Who agrees? Well, who disagrees?
Well, that's certainly the theory. I think the Republicans are scared. The more that the issue is defined as in fairness for our society, who should pay, how much should they pay, they're on the wrong side of public sentiment. That's why they have to turn this into class warfare and use rhetorical devices, because if it's on the issues, they're on the wrong side.
Byron.
Oh, the rhetorical devices won't win them the election. I mean, the public has shown an interest, an inclination to throw people out. I mean, clearly they were extremely unhappy with George Bush and the Republicans. They threw the Republicans out of Congress in 06 and gave the whole thing to Democrats in 08, and then they turned around and gave a smashing victory to Republicans for the House in 2010. I do not think rhetoric about class warfare will win the election for Republicans. On the other hand, remember when at the end of the Obamacare debate, they were having this big forum and they had members of Congress there, and at the end Obama said, well, we disagree and we'll just have an election. That's what's going to happen.
Gene.
Well,
I think an awful lot of our listeners resent health care being called Obamacare, just a word. Go ahead, Jane.
Well, I do think that this, we have been, as Byron said, in a very volatile political world right now. And I think the message from the voters has consistently been, do something to help us. And so far, nobody's done it. And it could be that next year they'll look for a whole new group to try to get the job done.
All right. And finally, tonight is Game 7 in the World Series. Who's going to win, the St. Louis Cardinals or the Texas Rangers? Who do you pick, David, quickly?
I'm not a Texas fan. I got to go with St. Louis.
And Gene.
Ditto.
Somebody's going to have to speak up for people who aren't watching. I'll pick either one.
All right. That's fine. Thank you all. Byron York, Gene Cummings, David Korn. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we are on Facebook and Twitter.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CenturyLink, providing broadband, entertainment, and voice products to Americans coast to coast. Learn more at CenturyLink.com. From Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese, and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at CabotCheese.coop. And from CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight, nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Mississippi voters could define a fertilized human egg as a legal person. Why advocates on both sides of the abortion issue warn the measure could have far-reaching consequences.